it's still early 2018, but it already looks like Jimmy Yang's big year. In August, Yang will co-star in Crazy Rich Asians, the adaptation of the first of a series of popular books about Chinese, half-Chinese, and Chinese-Americans, and the first major studio film to feature an all-Asian cast in 25 years. And Yang's new memoir, How to American, An Immigrant's Guide to Disappointing Your Parents, is just out from DeCapo Press. It's about his life as a ping pong phenom in Hong Kong, who came to America and made it in Hollywood. And then his dad, who doesn't think Yang is particularly funny, also made it in Hollywood and with much less work. At the moment, though, Yang is a series regular on HBO's Silicon Valley, which just returned for season 5, following the departure of Yang's longtime sparring partner TJ Miller and the Ehrlich Bachman character at the end of last season.
What if I told you there is an app?
Jing Yang, this is the assistant. We wait for the boss to pitch. The woman you saw outside, okay?
Oh, the lady who's a smoking. You said a note.
Sorry. Monica was smoking? Cigarettes?
Cigarettes.
No. He's confused. He's Chinese. He's talking about this crack addict prostitute we saw at the gas station. She was smoking cigarettes. So sad. Jin Yang, what are you doing? This is Palo Alto. People are lunatics about smoking here. We don't enjoy all the freedoms that you have in China, right? Where people smoke all the time.
I don't smoke, except for special occasions.
So you do smoke. Wait, have you been smoking in my house?
No. There's no special occasion ever happen in your house.
Hey, Jimmy Yang, I really appreciate you talking to me. We were talking a little bit before we started recording about somebody contacting you on Instagram about reading the book. So I wanted to kind of pick back up from what we talked about before we started taping and have you tell me about that.
Yeah, right before I called you, literally, I just got like the most touching Instagram message. And it's this kid that I don't know, you know, just a random Instagram message. He said, Jimmy, I just finished reading your book and totally got touched. I'm 15 and I just moved to the U.S. from China in late August. Still struggling with the English language, and your book is the first English book I have ever finished reading without others' help. I hope you do more movies and books so I can keep reading and having fun. I mean, come on.
That's phenomenal. That's how does that make you feel? I mean, as somebody who went through a similar experience.
It feels great, man. Like I teared up a little, you know. I think it kind of makes all the struggles that I went through and all the hard work that I put into my work now completely worth it. I don't care if my book just sold that one copy. Like that message itself made it worth it for me to write it, you know.
Well, you've got so much going on right now. You've got the book, and you've got Silicon Valley starting right now, and you've got Crazy Rich Asians coming out this fall, I guess are the main three things I wanted to talk about. Let's start a little bit with the book. It's called How to American, and you have these chapters that are very built around very discrete ideas called like how to immigrant, how to stand up, how to make it. Do you think about your life in something like chapters like this and having these sort of specific moments where you moved through something?
Yeah, I guess I do, because when I started writing it, I wrote it chapter by chapter. I think the first chapter I wrote was the How to Strip Club DJ chapter. And that was quite the dark time, the dark chapter in my life. But it kept flowing out pretty easily because there's plenty of material in there for funny and for, you know, darkness and just learning life lessons, you know. So yeah, I think we all go through chapters, and one of my fear was my life would just be one long chapter that's very boring. That's why I think I had a finance internship and I was offered a job at this financial firm, but I wanted more chapters in my life. I couldn't just settle down and sit behind this desk for 40 years and that will be the last chapter of my life. Like that almost gave me a panic attack. And that's probably why, you know, I gravitated towards the arts and stand up and acting, because now it seems like every job I take, every film, every TV show, every stand up set, that's a chapter in itself. So I guess that kind of what gets my juices flowing.
So you grew up in Hong Kong, and you write in the book about, and you were, it's hard to tell exactly from the book if you were being modest or not, but it sounded like you were some kind of a ping pong prodigy growing up. And you, well, yeah. I guess let's stop there. You were a prodigy and you're downplaying it a little, or you were just a really above average ping pong player?
I was very good, and I competed in all the Hong Kong tournaments. And in Hong Kong and China, I think most of, you know, the Eastern countries, ping pong is taken very seriously. It's like football. And, you know, I was basically one of the best kids playing Pop Warner football. I was a promising prospect, you know. I had really good form and everything, but I was just like a little too short and too like weak as a kid. So I never got the championships, you know, but I always finished third or fourth. And I actually made my very first TV debut when I was 10 years old on a local Hong Kong news when the interviewers interviewed me about playing ping pong. And I was like so cute. Everybody loved me. They invited me back like for like the next cable interview with me and my dad. And my whole school, the whole district thought I was like a star, you know, but I wasn't a champion. I was just like a dude that came in third and fourth, you know? And then that was quickly exposed when I lost the school tournament to some newcomer kid, very embarrassingly.
The part that jumped out at me about that, particularly given your career, you know, to date, is that you write that you intuitively understood how the A camera and the B camera worked, even though you had never been in a studio like that. I mean, do you remember that?
Yeah, that's 10 years old. I did distinctly remember that. You know, they're like, well, there's four cameras in the studio. You know, when the red light flickers on this, that's when the camera's on you on that. And then my head was just swiveling. Like, I kind of knew. I don't know. Even when I started stand-up, I had a pretty good like, I never had stage fear. I think I got that from my dad. He was a really good presenter, you know, back in the day when he worked sales and stuff like that. So, yeah, I mean, even though I had my struggle with, like, the English language and my skills in ping pong and such, but I've always had a pretty good, you know, stage presence, I guess.
You spoke Cantonese, Mandarin, and Shanghainese growing up. Did that make it easier to learn English, or was English so much different than Asian languages?
I think it's very much different. Maybe, you know, practice is foreign language or foreign even dialects within China helped me kind of form my brain linguistically a little better. But English is a totally different game, because those three dialects, they might sound very different and people might not understand each other, but it's still written in the same language, grammar. And so when it comes to English, a lot of words and orders of the words and phrases get jumbled, especially the slangs, you know, like one of the things I wrote about in the book, it's like nobody taught me what's up. Like, that's not a thing
right.
in school.
Right.
Something
you thought
take
that
for granted.
Literally yeah, meant say, up in the sky.
What is up? I looked up and, like, you know, the first day in school was very embarrassing. Like, that girl probably thought I was stupid or something. And also, it's not just the language, right? When you come to assimilating, when it comes to assimilating to America, it's also the culture. I didn't know what a Super Bowl was. I didn't know why it was such a big deal. I didn't know what, you know, hip hop music was. So when I first like listened and found BET, it was like opening a Pandora's box. I'm like, oh my God, I didn't even know this was a thing. You know, like Jay-Z's Big Pimpin' on a yacht with like beautiful women in bikinis and champagne and Cristal. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is the part, the America that I wanted to live in, you know?
Well, I interviewed Daniel Brühl, who's on The Alias, a couple of months ago for Playboy when the Alias started on TNT. And he talked about speaking, I think he speaks five or six languages and actually
wow.
works in a lot of these languages. And that just does not compute to me. I mean, I had, I don't know, 3 or 4 years of Spanish in high school and college. And I, you know, I'm not very nimble with Spanish at all. And
so for me, like a lot of people is like, well, you grew up in Hong Kong. Did you learn English, you know, in Hong Kong? I'm like, yeah, but I learned English how kids here would learn Spanish just on paper in school. But it was an immersive process. So like you now, if I drop you off in Mexico, you probably wouldn't be able to hang, you know?
Right.
So that's how I felt. Exactly. And, I still speak to my brother in Cantonese. Even in my in my home, I speak like three or four different languages because I speak to my brother in Cantonese because we both grew up in Hong Kong. And I speak to my parents in Shanghainese because that's the regional dialect that we grew up speaking to our family. And then, you know, when we watch TV, sometimes we'll watch it in Mandarin back home. But then sometimes when it comes to, especially like, say I get into an argument with my father or like my brother, I have to say things in English because I convey certain words better in English. So it's just a big mush in my head.
I mean, you've obviously learned how to write at some point. The book is very well written. You've got this lean and really active tone in the book that doesn't sound like English as a second language at all. There's a lot of you have a lot of movement and a lot of a lot of structural focus without having to sort of bury it in adverbs and adjectives. But there's just a lot to appreciate in the actual prose. Where did you figure out your style, or how did you learn to write the way you write?
I don't think took any like book writing classes or writing classes. I think it's doing stand up. I think one of the things that people don't realize is to be a good stand up comedian, you have to be a great editor of your storyline, right? Because you come out with just like a big piece of marble and you try to, you know, say these jokes that you thought about in your head, but most of it aren't funny. And then you learn to chisel away on this marble and then sculpt something that's actually presentable, you know? So it's a lot of trial and error and editing and the setup and punchline. I think everything at the end of the day, whereas it's a book, it's a TV show, or it's stand-up. It's all about setup punchline. You're setting up either a theme in a book and then you pay it off. You set up like what happened in my childhood and then I used this lesson to pay it off at the end. It's the same thing with stand-up. Stand-up is just you set up with, you know, a setup line and you say with a punchline. And in a TV show, you set up in the first act and then you pay it off in the second act when they resolve it. So everything is kind of all based on that. I guess for me, so it just kind of translated into a longer form, into a book.
I don't know if you're giving yourself enough credit. I mean, I've read enough comics who have written more humor oriented books than what your book is, which is closer to memoir, I would say. But you definitely recognize the difference between a spoken sounding, you know, sort of dialogue sounding book,
right,
and something that's more literary and has more of a written style. And I think you definitely write differently than you talk. I think you've definitely put some specific style toward what you're doing. So I think you may be selling yourself a little short of it.
Thanks. It's just, I guess I don't know how to explain it, right? Like maybe I'm just a good critic on myself, so I go through a lot of process of editing and then writing it until when I read it myself, it's good. So I don't ever try to put out anything, you know, below that bar, right? So maybe that's why, but I can't explain it. I don't know.
You've talked in the book about watching American movies growing up, and particularly big, noisy, effects-driven American movies, which is something that I recognize from Kumail Nanjiani's stand-up. Is that something that the two of you have talked about in the years you've been working together?
Yeah, we definitely talked a little bit about that. He came from Pakistan, you know, I came from Hong Kong, and we're never the guy that kind of uses that as a crutch, you know. We don't always talk about it. We just try to, you know, do our thing and be part of the American comedy world. And I think that's what makes us maybe a little more I'm trying to say, we don't use it as an excuse, right? Because I could easily, even like a failed audition, I could be like, you know, oh, it's because I'm an immigrant, or because I'm Asian, I never got it. I think that's what makes us who we are now. It's because we never used it as an excuse, and we just worked. And we almost used that to our benefit, because we had lived through like a different but yet very similar storyline, you know.
Where did you live when you came to the United States? Where did you move to?
Los Angeles.
And what was that experience like?
It's pretty crazy because Los Angeles is one of the most diverse cities. You know, you got Latino people, Black people, Asian people, and there's different types of Asian people, different types of Latinos. So it was culture shock because in Hong Kong, all my friends, all my classmates were just people from Hong Kong, Chinese kids that kind of grew up the same way. Whereas I came here, like even just looking at people, everybody looked different. I'm not just talking about skin color, but like there's this kid, Marquise. He was the Black kid, and he can dunk. He was like 6'2" when he was 13, and he was like almost 200 pounds. And I was like, incredible. I never seen that. And then There was a Latino kid. He had a full mustache when he was 13 years old, and I haven't even grown like any hair yet, you know? So even seeing that, you're like, oh my God, what is normal here? Like your kind of baseline is really skewed at this point, because in Hong Kong, everybody is kind of around the same size. There's a normal height, you know, for your age, right? Which I was always a little below that anyways. And there's almost like a normal look, but there isn't anymore when you come to America because everybody is so different. But there's something great about that because I just learned and observed, and it's like, it's so fun, like to see all these new, to me, almost like new forms of human beings that I've never seen before. It's like walking into a world convention. And that was very interesting to me.
So you grow up to age 13 in Hong Kong, then you move to Los Angeles and learn English, go to high school there, and then you wind up at UC San Diego getting an economics degree, and then you turn down a job to do stand-up.
A very good job at Smith Barney. It's like one of the top financial firms.
And what would you have been doing in that job?
I think I'll be helping clients, like a financial advisor, I believe, getting clients, helping them, you know, manage their funds and stuff like that and making a commission off of it. First of all, I just could not stand, you know, sitting behind a desk. Everything going to work was super dreadful to me. And that's just me. I know some people find comfort in that consistency, but I just couldn't handle it. And also, I just didn't really believe in that job. You know, I think now with all the trading platforms that, you know, me and you, we can manage our own money. And we don't, I feel like it's a very unnecessary job that I'm not really, at the end of the day, really helping anybody. I could be wrong, and I'm not like, you know, throwing shade on financial advisors. My dad was a financial advisor. I'm sure some people need that. It just, I didn't feel like I will be very content if I did that for the rest of my life. So that's why I turned it down. And when I turned down the job, I didn't even know what I wanted to do. I didn't know what I wanted to do, stand up. I was doing some open mics, but I wasn't sure if that was even going to make me any money down the line. But I was just desperately finding like a new creed and like a new group of people, a new group of friends that I can hang on to and, you know, find like a new chapter in my life.
So there was no stand-up TV plan at that time. You weren't Jim Carrey writing yourself a check for $1 million early in your career, deciding this is the plan and this is what you're going to do.
No, not at all. I had no idea. I think it eventually kind of unfolded itself. When I was doing open mics, I was just hoping to get better at comedy so I can get a couple laughs. Maybe I can talk to some girls. And then when I moved back to San Diego and I pursued even more comedy and I worked at a comedy club, I'm like, okay, worst come to worst, at least I can be a doorman at the comedy club and not starve to death. And then eventually when I start getting better, you know, I hear other comics talking about they can, you know, get a college agent and go do college shows for $2,000. And I was like, oh my God, that would be a dream. That would be amazing. And then, you know, step by step, as I did that, and then my other friends told me, oh man, you should do commercial auditions. And I'm like, oh my God, that would be amazing. I can make a lot of money on just one commercials, And, you know, from then I booked my first TV spot on Two Broke Girls. Still, I didn't think I could really make it on TV. I was just like, oh my God, this is great. Now I can go do more stand-up because of this Two Broke Girls credit. But then it just step by step, it kind of unfolds. And I'm not sure what the next step is still. But
you skipped one step. At what point along the way were you working at a strip club?
Yes. So after I quit the internship, or the potential job in finance, basically I had three jobs because I was just lost. I was just trying to make ends meet. I was trying to find myself. I sold used cars during the day, and I worked at a comedy club and went up on stage and worked as the doorman in the evening. And then after that, I worked as a strip club DJ. So I was just, I guess I was kind of giving myself options. So I'm like, if all else fails, I can sell used cars. If all else fails, I can like,
those are all terrible. Those are all terrible options.
It's probably like, yeah, horrible, horrible. But you know, when you're desperate, you know, you don't really have a choice. And I was a pretty good strip club DJ. So I guess that could have been my future.
When did you figure out you could do comedy or that you could act or do stand up or which parts of it that you felt like had a potential career path?
At first, I definitely didn't know because my dad, as I said at the book, ever since I was a baby, has told me that doing what you love is how you become homeless. That's not a thing. Pursuing your dreams is not a thing in Chinese culture, you know? So I didn't know that. And I didn't even know stand-up was really a thing, but I always said that Googling local open mics is one step away from Googling what's the easiest way to kill myself. So I was just desperate. I was just desperate. And then, you know, I went on a stage for 5 minutes. And like we talked about before, I realized I didn't have a lot of stage fear. So I was like pretty comfortable up there, even though I wasn't very funny and my jokes were very hack in the beginning. But there was some kind of sense of comfort. And I'm like, I'm actually okay at this. But then, you know, it's a ton of trial and error to, you know, eventually write your material.
You do a lot of jokes about your dad, which is probably, I would say, at least what I recognize in your stand-up more than anything else. What does he think about the jokes that you do? You write in the book some that you're not quite sure he gets it, what you're doing.
Yeah, no, he doesn't think I'm funny, so it doesn't matter. And I use that basically as therapy. he doesn't get stand-up comedy because a lot of it is very cultural anyways. He understands English, but he chooses to not understand my stand-up, which is okay. So, you know, it was never something he wanted me to do. He was sending me like careerbuilder.com emails for years. He's like, Jimmy, you know, you're not that funny. You should go find a real job. And so it's all right. I guess at this point now, I'm past the point of trying to please him with my stand-up comedy.
So then Silicon Valley comes along and you audition for this show where you've been there since the beginning, but have very little dialogue. Most of your scenes, you're on the screen reacting and then we'll mm-hmm. have something like a punchline or a misunderstanding
right.
that sets things up. When did, is that something that was always written for you and you made it work? Or is that something that developed out of conversations with the writers about the way language humor could work for a character like this?
I eat a fish.
I understand you eat the fish, but when you clean the fish, you can't just leave the fish head and guts and shit in the sink, because the whole house smells like a bait station. So you got to put it in the trash and then take the trash out. Do you understand?
Yes, I eat the fish.
Motherfuck!
So Jing Yang started off as a two-line part, and then it grew, and then I think it really clicked when me and TJ was working together. And the show works in a very interesting way. We never really sit down and have a conversation with the writers. They're very smart. Really geniuses. So they kind of see the dynamic on set, and then whatever is good, they write more of that, you know, and they're always on set, giving us even alternative funny lines to say. And then that along with our improv kind of really makes the show come alive. So I think, I mean, just something about me and TJ, I think in season two, the first day we're shooting, it was a mansion scene where like we're trying to get into the mansion and he doesn't have the money. And I'm just constantly throwing him under the bus. And then we really found like the dynamic and the comedy there. And that was the day when one of the producers, Clay Tarver, came up to me and was like, man, you guys are like the modern day Laurel and Hardy. And so I think a lot of the chemistry between me and TJ kind of developed organically, and the character just became more of themselves throughout the seasons. And so it came about fairly naturally, and it just worked physically with my size and TJ's size difference, our language difference, and how our personality differs. It's like the classic old school Laurel and Hardy combo.
And I had never heard you talk about this before in interviews, but in the book you write about how this style of humor that you have with TJ Miller on the show, that there's a corollary mm-hmm. to something like that in Hong Kong.
Oh yeah. So in Hong Kong and China in general, there's no stand-up comedy. That's why, well, there is a little bit now, but it's a Western form of art that has transferred now to the modernized, Hong Kong and China. Classically or, historically, there isn't, but there is a form of two-man act. It's almost between like a rhythmic rap and a sketch show with two people on stage, kind of going back and forth with each other, very much like me and TJ. And it's in Mandarin, it's called xiangsheng. And it's a very popular form that's been around for hundreds or maybe even thousands of years. So when my dad finally saw Silicon Valley, he kind of understood that. I think we just don't understand stand-up necessarily. I think that two-man form from Laurel and Hardy to the Chinese two-man act, it's been around forever, and we're just kind of rediscovering with me and TJ.
And with TJ Miller leaving the show at the end of last season, how does the show evolve, Jin Yang? Do you get a new foil mm-hmm. or do you change completely into a different type of presence on the show?
Yeah, I think at first I was definitely kind of sad and a little bit worried about Jin Yang. It's like, oh my God, he lost his partner. So what is he gonna do? But eventually, as I see the scripts come in, it kind of became a blessing in disguise, because now Jin Yang is not just confined to Ehrlich, and I get to kind of spread my wings a little more and interact with the other characters. I don't know if it's going to be, we're ever going to find a dynamic like me and TJ's, but it's great to, I think, and it's fresh, and it's still very, very funny to see me interacting with the other characters and, possibly being a pain in their ass also.
Crazy Rich Asians comes out in August, I think?
Yeah, August 17th.
And tell me about filming that. I mean, the book is pretty sprawling. There's a lot of characters. They're from all over mm-hmm. Asia and the United States. What was making that like?
It was amazing. It's the first studio movie in 25 years since Joy Luck Club that features a full Asian cast. That's amazing. And it took that long for some reason. So filming it was an incredible experience, because even just meeting in the lobby of the hotel for dinner, you see the most beautiful, the coolest, the funniest, the most talented Asian people from all over the world, from Australia, from America, from Singapore, and we all just hang out together. It definitely made all of us feel really proud to be Asian. And also at the same time, it made us felt a little more normal. We don't have to explain ourselves like we're the only Asian dude on set, or like we have to play the token Asian guy or something. All of us were Asians. There was a spectrum of Asian there. I can just be the funny guy. I didn't have to be the only Asian guy. And, that burden was kind of gone. I'm not representing all Asian people with my character. Everybody's just representing a type. So I think we kind of felt finally how white actors feel in America. And it felt great. I hope we have such a special experience. I think every TV show and movie I've ever done, I made one or two really close friends that I still talk to, that I still hang out with. But this movie, Crazy Rich Asians, we became like a fraternity and a sorority that everybody hangs out with everyone. Like when I went to New York last week, all I hung out with was my crazy rich Asian family. And we had just such a connection because we all had went through the same experience being a struggling actor against our parents, our Asian parents' will, you know, being the struggling Asian actor trying to make it in a westernized society. So there's some kind of familiarity and we just love each other so much. So if the, I'm hoping if the audience can just feel an ounce of that, this movie should be a success.
So are most of the people in the film playing something close to their own backgrounds or are they playing against their backgrounds? I think in the book, there's people from Hong Kong and China and people that have lived in the United States and people who haven't lived in the United States.
It's fairly close, but you know, we have somebody that's like half Japanese and half white. Somebody that may be half Chinese and half Korean. But, you know, we're more, I think, concerned about playing type than playing, you know, ethnicity. You know, I think that's more important to play type. Like, I mean, Ken Jeong in the movie with the comedic guys that are kind of crazy, you know, and Awkwafina, Nora Lum, which is kind of crazy comedic people. And then you have your romantic leading man type, like Henry Golding, Remy He, Chris Pang, these like good looking dudes that have six packs, you know. And then you have, you know, your romantic lead women like Constance Wu, who's a great actress and also beautiful. Right. And then you have like Gemma Chan, who is like the most beautiful person I've ever seen. So I think we're just playing types instead of, you know, worrying too much about playing ethnicity and keeping it authentic that way.
Well, you are right in the middle of a really interesting point in your career. And I'm really glad to get to talk to you at a time when you've got so much interesting stuff going on.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure, man.